Welcome to another edition of the Open Text Podcast, a series of podcasts intended to be revision podcasts for students studying the texts in BCE English. Tonight's episode is an interview with Helen Smith about the film Gattaca. Helen and I teach at the same school, and we've both been teaching Gattaca for a number of years.
Okay. Hi, Helen. Given the fact that we've been studying Gattaca all year, what kinds of things do you think we can say that's new about this text?
Well, the interesting thing about Gattaca is that it's not new. And people think, oh, it's this new thing, it's all about genetic engineering and so on. What I think is worth exploring is that, in fact, it's not new. In fact, it's part of a much longer story. And if you go back to the early writers of science fiction, I'll explain what I mean by science fiction in a minute. If you go back there, they were exploring exactly this same idea a century ago. It wasn't perhaps genetic engineering, it was something else that was current in their world, but was challenging their worldview. And they had to try and understand, what does it mean? So they wrote things like Jules Verne, Round the World in 80 Days and Voyage to the Moon. What would it mean to us if we did this? And what would happen to the nature of the world if we could travel so fast we could get all the way around it in 80 days? And it became the substance of the story. Good science fiction, and that goes back to where I gave a hint before, good science fiction is all about where are we now and what are the challenges we face and the decisions we need to make and the ethics we need to put in place that ultimately mean we make good decisions about current science or current politics or current attitudes or current ways we interact with each other. And good science fiction takes us out of that, oh wow, isn't science good, isn't future terrific, to what do we really want out of this experience and what do we need to reject. In fact, the story of Gattaca, if you line it up against a story written by Aldous Huxley in the 1930s, 32, called Brave New World, has enormous numbers of parallels. They're not exact parallels, they're not exactly the same story, but it was about genetic engineering, it was about the future, what choices do we make, what do we value, and in both cases, Brave New World and Gattaca, and if you want to go back even further, Time Machine with H.G. Wells, all talk about the need for human dignity, the need for work, the need for self-esteem, that perfection is an ideal which cannot be allowed to exist but only ever act as a goal and a direction. Because if you try and impose perfection, you will impose impossibilities and brokenness in the human nature.
It's really interesting that you've put it in the context of other science fiction works. Would the students need to be familiar with any of these other science fiction works, or is it enough that they realise what you've said, that it's not so much about the future as about our current decision-making? Do I understand you correct when you say that?
That's quite correct. It isn't necessary for any student to suddenly go out and buy Brave New World and read it, or read Time Machine, or go back and read Jules Verne. The principle of science fiction is, as you say, here are a series of challenges we are facing today. What decision are we going to make that means we can live with that decision in the future? And I was writing some thoughts about this a little while ago, and I was thinking about, well, when was there a time in our history, not too long ago, when we allowed the science to stand without question? And unfortunately, the science was terrific. It was all about helping the world fuel itself, encourage itself. It was going to save the world. It got into the hands of the military and the West, us, the Americans, dropped it on Japan, two atomic bombs. It was designed to provide the world with hope, and we got into the wrong hands and provided us with a weapon of mass destruction. And as a consequence, if we'd had a chance to think about that beforehand, might we, as critical thinkers and communicators in the world, have said, just a second, we're not sure we want that direction. But we were not given that choice. And as a consequence, we have lived with the horror of that decision ever since. Nobody thinks about that except in terms of its horror. Gattaca is one of those warning signs that says, do we want to go ahead with this science, this direction, this possibility for human interaction? It terms of writing an essay, you don't need to know all that history, but you do need to know it has a place in the context. That this was not just, well, let's make a happy little movie. It really was saying something important to us today about human beings, about our right to self-determine, not to manipulate so closely that we lose our essential humanity.
Gee, that's really interesting. I hadn't quite thought of it like that, but it does make a lot of sense when you think about it like that. Is there a character, do you think, in Gattaca that kind of epitomises that way of thinking that you've just talked about as a warning? Like, is there anyone in the movie that really helps us to think about those things, or do we as a viewer and as a thinker about the film have to make those connections ourselves?
I think it is essentially a whole movie response. Each character plays a part in it to test out thinking, to provide us with those challenges. Some are more heavily involved in asking the questions. Some are so single-minded, such as Vincent Jerome, who's so single-minded in his intention, he's almost dangerous to that effect.
Mm.
He runs the risk of really damaging a lot.
Mm.
But we admire him because he's doing the right thing. He is determining his own future and not being prepared to sit back and be told, you can't do that.
You don't think he's sold out to the whole ideology of the Gattaca Corporation?
Of course he did. But they provided him with the method of getting where he wanted to go. It's an entirely selfish perception. His world is entirely selfish, and he needs to make it selfish. At first, we don't see that in him, but as more and more is denied him, the more and more he holds closely to himself that which he has been able to gain. It can be so easily taken from him, he will not let it out, which is why he keeps so many secrets, which is why he has no friends outside that very, very small area. And why he goes to such lengths to keep the secrecy. It's essential for secrecy for him to be successful, and that means he must be entirely selfish.
So at the end of the film, when there's a sense that in his relationship with Irene, he becomes more, he's able to give more, do you think he becomes less selfish then, or the selfishness remains?
He has modified himself more. He has been prepared to share something of himself, and it is the greatest risk he faces during this whole sequence. That is before, of course, he goes to have that final test with Dr. Lamar.
Mm.
He thinks it's all over.
Mm.
But at that point, he makes the remark about, for so many years I've wanted to get off this planet, and now I'm not sure I want to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And it is because he has finally made another human connection with someone he can give to, and from whom he believes he can receive.
Yes.
With Eugene, it was platonic, great friends, I think, in the end, but a friendship that could say, I think I'll travel too, or I'm going away for 12 months, what will you do?
Mm.
I'll be okay. Mm. And they nod, and they acknowledge, and they move apart because it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
That part of their life is through.
Mm.
But with Irene, there is a deeper connection.
Mm.
It's not explored in any great depth, but we sense it.
Mm.
And suddenly he realises there's something in his life he has not permitted, for obvious and logical reasons, but he finds it far more attractive than he thought he would, and it challenges him. But it's not yet sufficient for him to stop himself going to Titan.
Mm.
He knows he'll be back in 12 months. And I get the feeling that Irene, after 12 months thinking about what all that has happened to her in those last few weeks before he goes, that in fact Irene will be one of his strongest advocates when he returns.
Yes, yes. In fact, I gather really that Vincent is a source of inspiration for Irene, that before she got to know him, she was very much accepting of the oppression of the Gattaca Corporation's rules and values and so on. But afterwards, that perhaps she and Vincent will make a statement against the Gattaca Corporation's values and so on.
It would be tempting to think that would be the case, but I don't know that they will. And this is entirely speculation.
Yes.
It's not about the text, and I wouldn't want students to think they could start writing about it.
No.
But this is a very powerful organisation. Irene is only just beginning to discover that she could stand against those principles. how would they sustain it? All it would take is for Vincent to be declared an invalid, and he's lost his voice.
Yes.
And unless someone is prepared to amplify that voice in some way in the community, that whole case is lost. Also, one has to ask, and again it's speculative, would they have children? And if they did, how?
That's never occurred to me, you know, Helen.
No, and I think it's probably something not worth exploring now because it will distract students from the exam. But you ask the question, is Vincent sufficiently prepared to back up his own beliefs about his ability to do whatever he wants to do to have a child with Irene?
Mm.
Is Irene, who suffered so much under this oppression and who hated it but could see no way out of it, will she allow herself to be the mother of a child who would suffer even worse than she did?
Mm.
Will they sell out?
Yes.
And go the same way the rest of the community does, because in the end, it's the only way to be sure that child will be okay.
Mm.
And it may be not his child.
Yes. It's interesting when you talked about Vincent, you know, being betrayed and perhaps being declared an invalid. You know, that was the risk he was taking during the time, and that's the need for all the secrecy. This reminds me of another time in our recent history, I suppose, in the last century, that, you know, of that kind of oppression happening and that kind of possibility of betrayal. Do you see any links between the way Nichols has looked at this kind of oppression and the discrimination between valids and invalids? Do you see any links there between, the Nazi Germany time of history?
Mm. I think Nichols is quite deliberately doing so. One of the characters in the story is called German. He's mm-hmm. never named German. Mm-hmm. It's on the cast list. Mm-hmm. He's the gene broker.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the, in recent history, practical genetic experimentation
mm-hmm.
to try and identify the Aryan race.
Mm-hmm.
And under the work of Josef Mengele, some terrible atrocities took place in the name of science, genetic science in particular, to try and find the master race.
Because he worked with twins, identical twins, didn't he?
Identical twins, mm. and he also worked with dwarfism mm. and mental retardation in some ways, just to try and identify what caused the genetic input mm. to those sorts of decisions. Mm. And some of the actions he undertook were appalling.
Mm.
And, you know, if Nichol has found his inspiration from there, then I'm not at all surprised, but I don't know that he did.
Mm.
Certainly, I think that's a deliberate pointing in the direction. Naming him German mm. is something that's it's an unusual name you would not normally give to a character.
That's
and
true.
His naming of characters mm. is very significant.
Yes, with Anton Freeman,
we know,
and
we can list them
Vincent.
All, and every student should have that list already,
yes.
so we probably don't need to do it again.
Mm.
But this is one of the ones that we tend not to look at, but I believe is a very strong pointer. Nichol is saying, don't forget.
Mm.
And there's that reminder.
And filmically, I feel there's a connection too, isn't it? When they're doing that search of the invalids in the invalid mm-hmm. camp, with the night that Vincent and Irene are coming back from the concert, and you see them, it looks very much like a sort of a prisoner camp. Yeah. Do you see that?
It's in a tunnel, dark,
yeah.
damp.
Yeah.
There is a sense of the lighting is coming from behind,
yeah.
except from a garish light in front, which
yeah.
feels spotlighted,
yeah.
That interrogation sort of sense.
Yeah.
And this, they're lined up
mm.
to be examined.
Yes.
And if we go back to that Nazi experience, that's what Dr. Mengele did.
Mm.
He stood at the end of the queue and, oh, lady, you go this way. Come on, grandmother, you go this way. Little girl, you go that way.
Mm.
And he directed them to the gas chambers
mm.
or to his experimentation or to work camps.
Mm.
And he did so, and many of the Auschwitz and other people, survivors, say he was such a lovely man.
Mm.
You felt, ah, finally a person I can warm to.
Mm.
And yet he sent them to their
mm.
deaths.
Mm.
So this lining up, this examination, even when the policeman
mm.
is polite,
mm.
you still know he has the authority
mm.
of life and death.
Mm.
And it's sinister.
Yes.
And it's ugly. We don't see his face.
Mm.
It is only a presence
mm.
of him. And that is the presence of authority and the presence of power.
Yes. And so even though there's those two epigraphs at the beginning of the film, the one about not interfering in nature and William Galen's statement that we will be interfering in Mother Nature, which direction do you think Nichols is sort of heading us or wanting us to look at? Do you think he has a clear position?
I think his position is tread warily.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is my own thoughts on it, I'm not sure. I don't wish to deny anyone the opportunity for improved health.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is a way we can improve health and reduce those dreadful debilitating illnesses that are of modern society, I don't want to be the one that says no. But at the same time, I don't want to be the one that diminishes the whole of humanity in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the potential.
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of Gattaca, as I started with this, was ask the question.
Mm-hmm.
And in the conversation which follows, we will determine what our group decision is. Perhaps he's not asking us to come to a specific decision, but to not let the matter go without good conversation.
Mm. So he sort of sees us as being almost at a crossroads where we could go either way at this point.
We need to make a decision.
Yes. Mm. I just want to ask you one final question. In The Age this morning, there was a... Not? Okay. Well, I was just going to say we might get rid of this, but Age this morning had the future evolution of the human race.
Oh.
And they talked about in about 10,000 years that the human race would divide into two, which were called the haves and the have-nots. And he was talking, the article was talking about genetic haves and genetic have-nots, and it reminded me very much of the valids and invalids of Gattaca.
And it's almost exactly what H.G. Wells talked about in the final society that the main character goes to,
mm-hmm.
the Eloi and the Morlock.
Mm-hmm.
The Eloi are beautiful, above-ground peoples, all blonde and lovely and frolicking in the sun. They appear to have everything, but the Morlock live underground and were originally the people who the have-nots, the workers, the underground tunnellers who built manufacturing and lived in the darkness. And what happened was that the have-nots then began to harvest the haves and provided them with the meat that they needed.
Mm.
That those who had perfection became incapable of doing anything.
Mm.
And as such, and were fed and cared for by the servant class, the have-nots, the ones who did all the labour, until the ones at the bottom said, this is an injustice we cannot allow to happen.
Mm.
We're hungry.
Mm.
They are meat.
Mm.
And so they became the cow that we would eat in our burger now, and they eat it. And this was the warning of H.G. Wells. His resolution to it was not something I think probably would work very well in today's society. But the haves and have-nots are with us now.
Mm.
There is no question.
Mm.
This is not. I'm not going to wait 10,000 years to see this.
Mm.
I only have to look at what's going on in the world.
Mm.
Australia did not sign the Kyoto Agreement. We have so much.
Mm.
And yet our failure to do something about repairing it means that those who have nothing will never get it.
Mm.
We won't let them have it because when we got it, we damaged the world.
Mm.
So we won't let them have it
mm.
even because we know it will damage the world. It means they get nothing else that came with it.
Mm.
We will always have the haves, and they will always be have-nots.
Mm. So this would be useful in thinking about the part two text, wouldn't it? If there
Very
was a
much.
Potential question on part two text, because I'm thinking the examiners are going to be racking their, or they would have already racked their brains to think of a new way of putting a question to elicit students' thoughts on some of these issues.
About a divided society.
About a divided society, yeah. Okay, well, I'd like to say thank you very much, Helen, and hopefully this will be useful to our students.